In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
When I was growing up, Memorial Day parades were a really big thing. I remember watching Jeeps going by and Army trucks towing cannons and feeling the ground shake as a tank rumbled by. I remember waving flags at the soldiers as they marched past. I remember going home and playing soldiers with my brothers and thinking America must be the best place on earth to live. It still is. I also remember the political parties being more united. I grew up in a Republican home, but I had friends who grew up in Democrat households. And as I grew into adulthood and became more aware of politics and policies, I never once had the sense that the Democrats wanted to destroy America. They just sort of did that by accident. Both parties, we were united in fighting the Cold War and defending the ideals of freedom. Somehow, the Democrat Party has taken defending freedom and turned that to imposing their sense of freedom on others and using the weight of government to do so. The IRS scandal to stop conservative groups. Fines if you're a baker and don't want to bake cakes for someone. And now threats of stopping federal funding for schools over bathrooms. This is a dangerous road, no matter if you're on the right or the left. But unity is hard to find, not just between parties, but even among Republicans. So on today's show, it's about unity. How the Conservative Party of New York has managed to unify its members, many of whom were Cruz supporters, to put their weight behind the Republican candidate Donald Trump. We're also talking about Memorial Day with Dr. Bonner Cohen, which was actually a divisive holiday in the beginning. We'll talk about its history, how it got started, and some stories along the way. To talk about unity for Donald Trump, the Republican Party's nominee, I'd like to welcome Mike Long, the chairman of the New York State Conservative Party. Mike, thanks for joining us today.
Great to be with you, Mark.
Yeah, let's get a little history on the Conservative Party and its formation. You guys started in 1962, I believe. But talk to us about how your party got started and why.
Well, we got started back in 1962 because at that time there was a liberal party in New York State, which was really have an immense amount of influence on both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. And if you remember back in the 60s or 62, the Republican Party at that point in history was run by Rockefeller, Javits, and John Lindsay. So the Republican Party was quite liberal at the time. And therefore, a couple of young people, young lawyers, with the help of William F. Buckley, formed, got a group together, and they started to form the New York State Conservative Party. Here in New York, unlike other places in the country, you can run, as we did, for instance, we endorsed Ronald Reagan in 1980, the Conservative Party did, and he ran on the Republican line and on the Conservative line. And at the end of the day, you can add the totals together. So back in, William F. Buckley helped form the party. Then he ran for mayor of the city of New York and got over 300,000 votes. His brother then ran, Jim Buckley, ran in 68 for United States Senate and got over 1 million votes. Then he ran again in 1970, that's James Buckley, and got elected a United States Senator on the Conservative Party line alone with over 2 million votes. So we've had a great history. We've no Republican in the state of New York now has won a statewide election since 1974 without the support of the New York State Conservative Party.
Wow. I think one of the things that makes the Conservative Party successful is New York's fusion voting, which allows candidates to receive votes from more than one party. Essentially, right. That allowed you guys to either co-endorse a candidate, putting your weight behind them, or in some cases, denying it. But I think one of the things that has made you guys successful is that you have managed to get Conservative Party candidates elected, not just for or against Republicans.
Yeah, we have done that a couple of occasions.
Yeah.
And but in all honesty, our biggest strength is when once we endorse a candidate, and for the most part, now these days, we endorse mostly Republicans because I think our pressure over the years has caused the Republican Party to, in New York, that is, to move a little bit more to the right. Mm. And if you're running for state senate or Congress or assembly, if you have the Conservative Party endorsement and you're in a Republican Party primary, it helps you win that primary. So the person who has the Conservative Party endorsement more than likely, almost all the time, wins the Republican Party primary.
See, and I think that's what's also unique about the way that you guys operate your party, because here in Oregon, we have a similar situation where you can have cross-party nominations, you know, so that you could both pick up, say, the Libertarian and the Republican nominations. But you guys tend to put your stamp of approval on the Republican rather than running a separate candidate altogether, and that's where we're very different. Oregon, the minor parties tend to put their own candidate forward instead of just simply saying, yes, we would also endorse this Republican. So I think that's really a unique take on things.
Yeah, well, it's not that we don't run our own candidates. Sure. There are many occasions throughout the state that we will run just our, if in fact the Democratic candidate and the Republican Party candidate is less desirable, then if where possible, we will run our own candidates.
So what do you say to Republicans then that when you guys run your own candidate and you know, because a lot of times they end up losing. I think there was the 2004 Senate race when you guys ran your own candidate. What do you say to Republicans when they say, well, wouldn't you rather have somebody in office that you agree with 60% of the time versus someone, you know, like a Democrat that you disagree with 60% of the time?
Yeah, I subscribe to that. As chairman of the party, I subscribe to that analogy. And I guess you would say Ronald Reagan's philosophy that I'd rather have an 80% friend than an 80% enemy.
Right.
And if you agree with me 80% of the time, we're going to try to do that. But there are certain key issues that the party holds very dearly. We happen to be a pro-life party. So if, in fact, not that we have not endorsed pro-choice candidates, but if you're for aggressively pro-choice, if you're for abortion on demand, there's no way you can get the Conservative Party endorsement, okay? So there's certain key issues that we think are very, very important, and that's just one of them, okay? And if you have a history, if you're an elected official and you're seeking higher office and you have a history of voting consistently for higher taxes and larger government, you're just not going to get the Conservative Party endorsement. So, I mean, we believe that once you earn the Conservative Party endorsement, there's an obligation to try to govern and legislate in a conservative manner, meaning smaller government, less taxes, enforcing the laws of our land, and preserving the future of our nation with a strong military.
Yeah, well, I think that's a great approach that you guys are out there withholding or giving your endorsement as long as they subscribe to those ideals. We are up against a break, though. Everyone stay with us. We'll have lots more with Mike Long. Stay with us. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show, helping you keep an eye on big government. Today we're talking about unity, getting the conservatives behind Donald Trump, the Republican Party's nominee. And we're talking with Mike Long, the chairman of the New York State Conservative Party. Recently, you guys had an article come out in Newsmax where it said the Conservative Party came out overwhelmingly supporting Trump. Do you think that took people by surprise, especially the whole overwhelmingly part?
Well, in the interview, in all fairness, and I'm not backing away from the interview, I was asked by the reporter, did I think we're going to have a convention in September. And he ultimately asked me that did I think we were going, what was the feeling of the party leaders up and down the state of New York? And my answer was that we're probably going to go, not probably, but we will be going with Donald Trump. And he said, does he have that? I said, I think overwhelmingly, the rank and file leaders of the party will support Donald Trump. They may not have been for him from day one.
Sure.
Considering the fact there were 17 initially candidates, and there was many of the candidates, many of our leaders were divided amongst many of the candidates, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio. There was a clear, so Carly Farina had a lot of support in our party. So there was clearly a division, and we usually move out earlier and faster. And this time, as leader of the party, I thought it best, because of the divisions of the various leaders and their various opinions of and support for different candidates, we held back. Hmm. Once it became evident that Trump was going to win the nomination, in my speaking with the various leaders up and down the state of New York, it became apparent, some very enthusiastically, some dragging their feet, some still questioning whether they're enthusiastic or not. But the answer was, overwhelmingly, most of the leaders will be supporting Donald Trump.
Hmm. So are there still some holdouts who say that they will never vote for Trump?
Well, I think there's very few right now in the party. I think as this crystallizes, my party leaders understand very clearly what's at stake here. And what's at stake is we don't need four more years of Obama. Hillary Clinton represents those four more years. We don't need to allow and take the gamble to have Hillary Clinton appoint the next two or three Supreme Court judges.
Yes.
Which would change the dynamics and the direction of this country for decades to come.
Mm-hmm.
So what's at stake here is the Supreme Court. What's at stake here is the direction we're going to, the leadership that we're going to move this country in. Now, I understand Donald Trump is untested. I understand there's lots of questions about him. But given the choice and it's the right candidates for Supreme Court, which I think he very cleverly announced the roughly 11 possibilities that he would appoint to the Supreme Court, that's a clear good signal that I think we're going to be much better off with a Trump presidency, certainly than having a corrupt Hillary Clinton and having Bill Clinton back in the White House. I mean, this is not what we need for the future of the country.
No, absolutely not. And it's pretty clear that it's going to come down to either Trump or Hillary. And so you better decide which of those two that you want. And
you just got to make that decision. And this is not about and Trump has his campaign is he's not running as a liberal, and that's for sure.
No.
Whether his past performances or something else. But he certainly is not enunciating liberal causes. I don't sign off on everything he has said, but his thrust is certainly not one of a liberal cause.
Yeah. Now, out here in Oregon, we still have a lot of holdouts on the Cruz side that they say that they will never get behind Trump. They're going to write in Cruz in the general election. Do you have that same sense there in the Conservative Party?
There are people here in New York that... and maybe some of my leaders and some of the rank-and-file registered conservatives feel the same way, maybe towards Ted Cruz or even other candidates, okay?
Hmm.
Trump sometimes makes it a little difficult for people to support him.
Yes, he does. Yes.
Okay, so I understand that. But my hope is that between now and November, that the very people that are talking about writing various individuals in, we'll take a serious look at, especially if we're close to winning this presidency, and I believe he can win this. I believe she is a tired candidate with no new ideas.
Right.
I think meaning Hillary Clinton, is being very well hampered by Bernie, and a lot of people are feeling the burn throughout the country. And I think, we don't need politics as usual. We need to... The country is in trouble. The system is broken. And maybe Donald Trump said, look, the people have spoken loud and clear. And they picked Donald Trump, and maybe he's the solution. Hopefully he is the solution to get, bring back the American dream.
Yeah, and I think that it gets back to that argument that we talked about earlier, that I'd rather have an 80% friend than an 80% enemy. We only got about a minute here with you in this segment. William F. Buckley was a founding member of the Conservative Party, as we mentioned in the last segment, but he also founded National Review, which has effectively declared itself pro-Hillary and never Trump. If Buckley was alive today, would he be for Trump, and what would he think of his magazine stance?
Well, Bill, look, I know Bill well, and I can't speak for Bill, and I don't know ultimately what Bill would do. And I don't disagree with the, I'm not walking the line here. I don't disagree, and I understand very clearly the editors and the writers of National Review, what their problems are with Trump. My hope that, and I think some of them are slowly turning, taking a more positive attitude on, you know, the outcome of this election in November. That doesn't mean everyone will jump on board, but my hope is that they will. But I do [S2] Yeah. [S1] Respect and understand their philosophical thrust. But, you know, and I have the same philosophical beliefs. I consider myself a Reagan-Buckley conservative. But I run a political party, and I don't have the opportunity to pontificate on philosophy only.
Right, and that's what it comes down to a lot of times, is you're not just supporting a candidate, but a lot of times you are stopping the other candidates. So, all right, let's go ahead and take a break. Coming up, we'll talk with him about the Trump presidency and what that would look like. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. Talking today to Mike Long, the chairman of the New York State Conservative Party, about unifying behind Donald Trump. And coming up here, I mean, you mentioned, let me just jump in here. Do you consider Trump to be a conservative?
Not necessarily.
and yet your party is still supporting him.
No, I consider him enunciating conservative ideas. I consider the way he's framed his campaign and enunciated many of his statements is talking about some conservative themes, about building and rebuilding our military, about rebuilding our standing in the free world, about controlling our borders. And, you know, a country can't survive if, in fact, we have no rules, no regulations, and no borders, and people just can come and go.
Sure.
A country will in fact, disappear if, in fact, we don't control immigration and live up to the laws that are passed. So I think those themes are not liberal themes. So while I don't believe Donald is a movement conservative, I don't believe he's a liberal. I do believe that my hope is that he would govern as a conservative if elected. And there's a lot that is not known about Mr. Trump and how he would, in fact, govern.
Sure, because he doesn't have that public record.
I think he got a clear signal when he announced I believe it was 11 people, who he said he would consider for the United States Supreme Court. I think that in itself was a very positive signal from Trump himself on where he's going and how important the appointments of the next one or three Supreme Court judges will be for the future of my children and my grandchildren.
Yeah. Well, and that's kind of where I'm at, too, is that, I mean, when you look at all of the effects that a Trump presidency would have in comparison to Hillary, I mean, he's certainly conservative enough as far as I'm concerned, and in comparison to Hillary, he's practically Reagan-esque when you compare the two policies. During this primary, one of the things that made me seriously consider Trump when he released his position on the Second Amendment, I think that was one of the best policy positions on the Second Amendment I'd seen in quite some time. I also thought his foreign policy speech was very good, and in my opinion, very conservative in a lot of ways. As you have looked through some of his policy positions, how do those line up, you think, with the Conservative Party?
I think many of them line up very well with conservative ideas and principles. You know, naturally, I his negotiation and rhetoric about the tariffs, I question. But, you know, Donald Trump is a sort of a negotiator, and I think he sends messages to various people that you're not going to get away with bad trade deals anymore. So, you know, that might send a clear message to some of the people that have been taking advantage of America and giving us bad trade deals. And we've certainly been on the short end of the stick in many of those deals. So, you know, I like his style of a bully pulpit stating things. Look, I don't believe 11 million people are going to be picked up and sent out of the country, but I believe he's sending a real clear signal that we're just not going to tolerate sanctuary cities anymore, and we can't.
No, absolutely not. You know, I mentioned that Second Amendment policy, and when it first came out, there were several Cruz supporters that I know that immediately blasted it because they were repeating headlines that they'd seen elsewhere, mostly on Cruz sites. However, it was clear that they hadn't actually read the policy because it was very pro-Second Amendment. And when they did finally read it, it really changed their minds. Do you have that same experience with Cruz supporters out there that a lot of them just have never read or listened to Trump, but are rather continuing some spin that they read elsewhere on some anti-Trump website?
What really happened is they wanted to hear what they, you know, we all fall prey to that sometimes. You want to hear what you hear or what you think you believe. And those Cruz people were very dedicated people, and they just wasn't accepting the inevitable, what was happening, and that Donald was moving forward and was ultimately going to be the nominee of the party. And so it's hard for them to swallow that. And look, my hope is that many of them come over, if not all of them come over, for the sake of the nation. That's where I'm at this.
Yeah, absolutely right. And again, the only other choice in this race is Hillary, and that's just reprehensible to even think about. I only got a couple minutes here. Real quick, do you think New York is in play for Trump, I mean?
I think New York traditionally would not be in play, but I can tell you the momentum for Trump upstate New York is phenomenal. Mm-hmm. Western New York is, from your old neck of the woods, is absolutely phenomenal, the amount of people that are supporting Trump out in Long Island. So I think there's a that New York could be in play.
Going forward, what would you say to former Cruz supporters, both here in Oregon and in New York and across the nation, about uniting behind Trump?
What I would say to them, look, I respect their love and admiration for Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz, without a doubt, is a solid constitutional conservative. I think he's a great leader, and I think he has a great future for speaking out for conservative values and for the country. But I would ask them to think of the country first and understand what is important for this next. 2016 may be one of the most, like every election is important, but 2016, after 8 years of moving in the wrong direction with executive orders and more restrictions being put on our Americans by this president, 2016 is maybe the most important election we're going to see in American history.
Yes.
With the possible appointment of certainly 2, 3, maybe 4 Supreme Court judges. We need not to allow Hillary Clinton to win that Oval Office. We need to win it with Donald Trump. He may not be a Ted Cruz, but I believe he'll move the country in the right direction.
Yes, I absolutely agree with that. And just imagine Supreme Court with a conservative advantage of 7-2. Mike Long, I want to thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure.
All right, thank you. And coming up, we're going to be talking about Memorial Day with Dr. Bonner Cohen. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. We're going to shift gears now and talk about Memorial Day and the history of it. And to do that, we're talking with Dr. Bonner Cohen. He is a senior fellow at the National Center for Public Policy Research. He's also a senior policy advisor with the Heartland Institute and a scholar at this Competitive Enterprise Institute. Dr. Cohen, it's good to talk to you.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
So let's start off with maybe some of the early history of Memorial Day and how it all got started. It seems there's a bit of tug of war over there, out there, over who gets credit for thinking up the idea of Memorial Day, with some 25 towns claiming to have founded the holiday, which was originally called Decoration Day. Waterloo, New York is the official one by act of Congress, but it claims to have been started there in May of 1866. So what can you tell us about the beginnings of Memorial Day?
Right. Well, the holiday that we now celebrate as Memorial Day has its origin in the American Civil War. And the very first celebration of Memorial Day, the very first one that we can truly document, actually took place in the South in Savannah, Georgia, in 1862. And you're quite right. Originally, this day was called Decoration Day. Seems like an odd name for us today, but what they were referring to was the tradition, which dates back hundreds and thousands of years around the world, actually, of people decorating the graves of fallen soldiers with flowers. And the celebration of Memorial Day throughout the Confederacy. It was just something that started in Savannah. As years went on, other celebrations were in Columbus, Georgia, and in a little town called Columbus, Mississippi. Mm-hmm. Also in the North, the first one that we have some documentation on is a place called Bowlesburg, Pennsylvania, which also had its Decoration Day in 1864. The interesting thing about all of these celebrations were that they were local. They had no national significance at all, in part because at the time the nation was divided, and also because the local officials at the time were simply commemorating the local soldiers who had been killed. After the war ended, in the spring of 1865, the Grand Army of the Potomac, which was an organization formed after the war, in building on the name, of course, Army of the Potomac, decided that it would hold something called, again, Decoration Day. And the first one of those days that was held, quote-unquote, nationally, but it was held in Washington, but wasn't really a national event, at least not yet. But over time, the tradition took hold. There was both a Decoration Day in the North, as well as on a separate day, a Decoration Day in the South. In fact, the South is the one that gave us the name Memorial Day, later calling it Confederate Memorial Day, so as to distinguish it from the one that had existed that was beginning to come about in the North. So the North-South divide over Memorial Day actually went on after the Civil War. Over time, the name Decoration Day faded and was replaced by Memorial Day. And we actually didn't officially decide to call it Memorial Day until an act of Congress in 1967. And it was also then decided that the day would be celebrated on the last Monday in May. That is the holiday that we will be celebrating here in a couple of days. And it's a celebration which there's some confusion. We have both a Memorial Day and a Veterans Day. The difference is this. Veterans Day commemorates all those who served in the armed forces. Memorial Day commemorates those who served and did not come back.
That's right.
And therein lies the difference between the two holidays.
It's interesting that so many of these kind of sprang up spontaneously all around the country there. And it's not like today where we're all connected on the internet, so it's obvious that these were sort of independent thoughts. Prior to a Decoration Day, did they do anything for like Revolutionary War heroes at all? Was there any kind of events or days set aside for that?
There were, and there were local events around the country throughout to commemorate those who were killed in the Revolutionary War and in the War of 1812, as well as the Mexican War. But they were strictly local events. There was no national tradition of a Memorial Day or Decoration Day at the time. Tragically, it took our most bloody conflict, 1861 to 1865,
right.
to bring about the holiday that we now know as Memorial Day.
Hmm. Okay, and we are definitely up against the clock, so everyone stay with us. Lots more on Memorial Day after this. And welcome back to the Ice Bar Radio Show. Today we're talking about Memorial Day, it being Memorial Day weekend. And to do that, we're talking with Dr. Bonner Cohen. He is a senior fellow at the National Center for Public Policy Research. He's also with the Heartland Institute and Competitive Enterprise Institutes as well. And so you're talking about the earlier history there of Memorial Day and how it all got started. And just to reiterate something that you said, that was strictly for the soldiers that fell in the Civil War. In terms of the mood of the country, we're just coming out of a Civil War there. As you said, that it was the bloodiest conflict still to this day, I believe, in terms of soldiers lost in the war. In terms of doing this Memorial Day, was the mood of the country to start unifying, or was it just simply, we won and you guys lost?
It was more the latter than the former. This is why for many years you had two competing Memorial Days, one in the North and one in the South. And it took many decades for the wounds to heal. And as I said, for a long, long time, lasting well into the middle of the 20th century, there was a separate Confederate Memorial Day, which over time came to commemorate the whole idea of the lost cause of the Confederacy.
Hmm.
It wasn't necessarily an anti-Yankee thing, whereas in the earlier part of the celebration in the North, particularly after the end of the Civil War, it was not uncommon for the various speakers who would hold forth at events to condemn the atrocity of rebel soldiers, and over time that gradually gave way to a more unified view, which probably coincided or appears to have coincided with World War One, which the very first time the North and the South had soldiers in the same war again was actually the Spanish-American War, but it was a relatively short-lived conflict. But it wasn't until after World War One, when we had soldiers both from the North and the South, as well as other parts of the country, taking part in the same conflict, which again fostered the idea of national unity and national reconciliation. It's also worth noting that during the Civil War, you also had a celebration or commemoration of those who fell immediately in the aftermath of the Battle of Gettysburg. And this is, of course, where Lincoln gave his Gettysburg address. And over the years, there were numerous celebrations, the Battle of Gettysburg, separate from the from Memorial Day, but something of a first cousin of it. And one of the more interesting things about that is that there was a reunion of soldiers who fought at Gettysburg in 1913, 50 years after the battle. And Confederate soldiers lined up who came to Pennsylvania. By this time, these men were generally in their 70s. And they reenacted Pickett's charge on the third day. A bunch of 70-year-old men walking across the field. Some of them actually had participated in the real Pickett's charge and were fortunate enough to have survived. Others were simply, going along for the ride. They reenacted the same thing 25 years later in 1938, by which time these men were well into their 90s.
Wow.
And still took that long walk, some of them perhaps in wheelchairs or being assisted, from where Lee's lines had been across over the Seminary Ridge where the Union soldiers were under General Meade had been waiting for them 75 years earlier, rifles in hand. So it's a remarkable story. Again, it's separate from the formal Memorial Day, but it certainly is related to it in spirit.
Yeah, and I've seen pictures of that 1913 event, and I've been to Gettysburg twice. Boy, I tell you, if you're a parent out there wondering where to take your kids, that is, I would highly recommend going to Gettysburg. I mean, it's just such, it's so flush with history. But in terms of that 1913 event, it was so touching to see those former combatants eating and drinking together and picnicking together. And as you say, you know, reenacting Pickett's Charge there. I mean, it really was very touching. And to see how those old conflicts have just really melted away, you know, and the wisdom of age coming out as well, in the sense that, you know, these old conflicts just really, you know, maybe they weren't as important as they were in the day.
Oh, yes. In fact, when the lines of Confederate soldiers did reach the wall, the Union, the 70-something Union, 70-year-old Union soldiers crossed the wall. They went out. They embraced.
Yes.
And as I said, they did the same thing 25 years later when the men on both sides were in their 90s and a few were over 100 years of age. Absolutely remarkable.
That's astounding. Okay, let's go and take a break right there. Coming up, we'll have some more on Memorial Day with Dr. Bonner Cohen. Stay with us. And welcome back. Nice Fire Radio Show. We're celebrating Memorial Day today. And we are, we will be on Monday anyway. But we're talking about the history of Memorial Day with Dr. Bonner Cohen. And, you know, we were talking during the break there about how fascinating it is that they did that 75-year anniversary at Gettysburg. And you were saying that some of the reenactors, the people that had been there the first time, they end up dying there on the field during the reenactment.
That's right. They survived the bloodshed in 1863, only to die of natural causes at that very same place 75 years later. But at least they could, you know, they had the comfort of knowing that they were given 75 years that many of their brethren were not lucky enough to have gotten. And I think the losses on both sides in that battle, of course, were absolutely atrocious.
Yes.
And I think the Lee lost 28,000 men. Meade lost around 24. Those were casualties. That's over 50,000. You figure at least a third of those died. So you had something like 20,000 men died there in the 3 days of the battle. So these men who did survive all the way to 1938 were truly blessed.
Yeah, how ironic to have survived the battle but then die of natural causes on the battlefield 75 years later.
On the same battlefield.
And what's interesting, too, is that reenactment took place in the shadow of the coming World War II.
That's exactly right. That's right.
Yeah.
Speaking of World War II, our listeners might be interested in knowing that Memorial Day is not necessarily something that is celebrated just in the United States. There are Memorial Day commemorations around the world, wherever U.S. soldiers were, or at least in most places where they were. There will be Memorial Day commemorations at American military cemeteries in France, United Kingdom, Belgium, Luxembourg, Denmark, the Philippines, and elsewhere. And As fate would have it, the day that we chose for Memorial Day is actually about a week before the anniversary of D-Day, June 6th.
Yeah, right.
And so, as you know, there are tremendous American military cemeteries in Normandy as well as elsewhere in France.
Yes,
are in Normandy, and even today, local French citizens, many of them. Children, grandchildren of those who were there at the time, the civilian population of France at the time, when after the D-Day invasion, will come out and put flowers on the graves of the fallen American soldiers. And as I said, this is something that you will see in a lot of places in Europe as well as in the Philippines.
Well, and I've seen some of those celebrations there in northern France on you know, the shores of Normandy and surrounding there, and some of those are exceptionally touching. And even to this day, you can see it on their faces how grateful the people of France are for, you know, the sacrifices that our soldiers made. And
right. The joke was that when an American soldier went back to Normandy, well, it was on the anniversary of June 6th or Memorial Day, just happened to be there, he never had to worry about buying a drink. It was always taken care of by the local people. He would walk into a bistro or something, and it was obvious he was American. And once they found out that he was a soldier there, drinks were on the house.
Wow, how cool. Well,
I might also add that as we sit here today, I'm in Arlington, Virginia, and Arlington National Cemetery is about two blocks from where I am. And in a couple of days, this town is going to be full of one of the more modern expressions of Memorial Day, and that's Roaring Thunder.
Mm.
And these are guys, most of them Vietnam veterans, who come to Washington once a year on their Harley Davidsons, usually with a wife or girlfriend on the back. And they meet at Arlington National Cemetery, where there is a commemorative event, then get on their motorcycles, cross into Washington, D.C., and go to the mall. It's a very moving ceremony. The noise of those Harley Davidsons is amazing.
Mm.
And you see these guys now, most of them in their late 60s or early 70s, but they come to Washington every year to participate in, as I said, the latest expression of Memorial Day, which is Roaring Thunder.
Yeah.
By the way, these are not biker gangs. These are, you know, hard-working people who have just kept their loyalty and their patriotism, and show that loyalty.
Yes.
And their patriotism.
Yeah. Yeah, they're exceptionally patriotic, that group, and I'm avoiding using the pun "waking the dead" because it is very loud, but certainly the dead can hear it.
Well.
Yeah, certainly the dead can hear it. I would think and be very honored by that. Dr. Cohen, we're wrapping things up here. I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and have a very happy Memorial Day.
All right, you too. Thank you so much. It's interesting that Memorial Day started out in a way that was divisive, honoring only the Union soldiers, and so the South had to come up with their own holiday. You know, in many ways, America today is also divided. Racial tensions, political tensions, and here under Obama, we're more divided than ever, it seems. Perhaps that's why so many people are uniting around Donald Trump, because it's clear that we need a leadership change. The problem here comes because the Obama administration has focused so much on what divides us rather than what unites. This person is black, that person is not. And here we are at the end of the Obama administration, and he's introduced yet new things for Americans to be divisive over, flooding the country with illegal immigrants and refugees, many of whom have no business being here. They are not coming here to be Americans, but to take advantage of Americans. That's not uniting. It's time to stop finding reasons to divide America. It's time to unite. So many thousands of our best and bravest believed in America enough to put their lives on the line for freedom and liberty. Freedom and liberty does not mean that you can do anything you want. It means you can be what you want, believe what you want, while giving others the space to be and believe what they want, even if you believe they're wrong. But you don't have the right to impose your beliefs on someone else, and that's where we've gone so wrong. I'd like to think that many Democrats out there and many of my old Democrat friends recognize this. I believe they do. But we are facing a crossroads. I know that many Cruise listeners believe that they can stand on principle and not vote for Trump, and this won't make any difference. But here's the thing. The country will end up with one or the other, either Trump or Hillary as president. One of those will be president. So you're not just voting your choice, you're voting for who will be the choice of all of us, including you. So who's it going to be? So many thousands died to give you this chance at this moment in time to stop Hillary. All around the world, there are fields of white crosses adorned with American flags. Don't turn your back on them. It's time to unite. Wishing all of you a happy Memorial Day and a big thank you to those who served and died for this nation. Visit iSpyRadio.com for links and podcasts come Monday. Follow us on Twitter at iSpyRadio. And like us on Facebook, because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.